cannot use.
Right. A certain preference.
You can read them for 1 minute. And then when the minute's up, you've got to put all your slides and your computers and all your junk away. Oh, okay. Actually, it's good. We're talking about the midterm, because the midterm will be on... I know, that was a great transition. I know you guys love talking about midterms and shit. Okay, so first of all, I want to remind you there's an extra class this Saturday.
Yeah.
Party erase Saturday morning. So, actually, it's a very important lecture, the Saturday one. So you guys should all show up. It's about DNA. It's the introduction to DNA. And without knowing it, it's kind of hard for you to know the next part of the course. So please do come. And if you email me about not being able to come, I took that into consideration. But everybody should try to come, because I said earlier that if you could make it, you should. So that's on the 31st. Is that right? 31st. And then there's a Halloween party that night. And then the 3rd and then the 3rd of November is a holiday in which we have a class. This is classic Waseda. Yeah. Just like, you got to get your money's worth. So here's an extra class. They're not paying me much, but you guys got to get your money's worth. So we have the 3rd and the 10th to talk about DNA-related stuff, replication, stuff like that. Actually, a lot about genomes in general also, so evolution and genomes. And then what I was saying is on the 17th, is that right? The 17th is the midterm.
What?
Yeah, it should be the same as the syllabus, but the 17th is the midterm. Like I said, I will have the slides uploaded before... 8 a.m. the 17th of November. So what you should know is it's between 40 and 50 questions. It's going to be multiple choice. So I think you should bring a pencil. I think the form is in pencil. You can bring a pen just in case too, but bring a pencil for sure. And your student ID, that's kind of all you need, I think. And then in terms of the format, like I said, you should definitely know the questions are in here. And then also you should know some of the stuff that's on the exam is not on the slide per se, it's based on what I say. But if you kind of understood the lecture, it should be okay. You should be able to reason it out by the process of elimination. Yeah, and then it's the grading is, okay, I think the way we're graded, officially this is the way we're grading the grading. Usually my exam's a little bit harder than other people, but I don't know what Tom, so Tom hasn't shown me what he's done, but when I taught at Sills, that tends to be what happens. So what that means is that it's curved only to your advantage, okay? You know what that means? So what that means is everybody... If I look at the scores and it's 4 follows the normal distribution, then you go the whole, 68% in between, anything above that is A plus, that kind of thing. So, and then if you go below like 60 or something, you fail. But if it's the case that this curve is shifted too much to the left, which means that there's too many people earning low scores, then we artificially bump up everybody by curving. So that there's two meanings to that. One is, first of all, you should not count on having anything curved, right? You should try to get over 90% of questions correct. If you do that, you're getting some sort of A, right? So it's not going to curve down, you know what I'm saying? It's not going to be like, oh, you got 98, but everybody else got 100. Bam, right? That's not going to happen. So, but the other thing is that also means that... on this exam, there are necessarily going to be questions that are a little bit difficult. Like, it might not be easy to surmise just based on everything, that you have to kind of reason it out and figure it out. So, but anyways, I think it will be a fun exercise for you guys to, if you're here and you're listening and you're interacting, you're probably getting a good grade. Okay. All right, so since it's important, I'm going to go ahead and get started. We're talking about protein function mostly today. So last time we talked about protein structure, we talked about amino acids. This time we're talking about the actual proteins themselves. Some of this first, let me just review what we kind of talked about. And first is that protein, they have binding sites. And these binding sites are very specific for certain molecules. And they kind of, like people say, they fit kind of like a lock and key or like a glove in a hand. Right? So very specific interactions. The binding sites also tends to restrict access. So what that means when I say here is that they like to basically remove the water, basically. Like the water can't just all go into the binding sites. They have this kind of limited access. And what that means is that only sometimes are you going to get, like, even molecules be able to invade the site. And when they do, they have kind of these bonding with each other in the site. So that's a very specific interaction. So you can kind of think of it as a magnet, right? So nothing going on. But when it gets in, boom, it kind of hooks on because of the multiple covalent interactions, charge interactions, the various interactions we talked about before. So the other thing is they often like to have polar groups. So polar groups, remember, are going to interact with the water, so that will allow some water access. When you have some of that access, when a molecule comes in, they can displace the water and the polar-polar interaction. Remember, hydrogen bonds basically is kind of a polar-polar interaction. Right? You have the oxygen that's slightly electronegative with the hydrogen that's slightly electropositive having a kind of a temporary, well, not temporary, but kind of weak bond between themselves, right? So that's the kind of thing that happens in the protein as well. So one interesting thing is that they actually use these algorithms, computational algorithms now, to identify sequences that are important. So what they do is that it's similar to DNA analysis, but in this case they're looking at proteins, right? So amino acids. So what they do is they look at the amino acid sequence of a protein, right? And what they do is they kind of map out important ones that come up over and over again. So it's kind of just like reading a tape, right? Every time you see that same sequence, you say, oh wait, this is probably important in some way. What they find is that when you actually do the mapping and you analyze just those pieces of sequences that occur over and over again in different proteins, in different organisms even, that they tend to be the same sequence. And then when they actually go in the biochemistry and look at what that what that actual sequence is looking like three-dimensionally, so like a yeast 2 hybrid assay or something like that, where they look at protein function, they find that actually these are mostly in the binding site, because the binding site has to be well conserved to kind of hook up with the same molecule, the same ligand each time. So you guys know the term of a ligand, that's just the thing that binds the binding site, right? So so from this, actually, it's actually really hot heel. If you guys are at all interested in mathematics, application to biology, so like bioinformatics, is actually a really big thing right now, because there's a lot of data being accumulated about different enzymes, proteins, and stuff, but there's a lack of people who are experts in understanding what those sequences mean. So it's not just that you have the same sequence over and over, and the same. Sometimes it's subtle changes, right, because you have a deletion that changes one amino acid that may not have an effect, for instance, but three-dimensionally it looks about the same. Or you have one where you change and the whole structure changes because, you know, for example, that positive charge went missing and it doesn't bind a particular molecule anymore, right? So what that means is when they're actually doing this tracing, they don't just do two-dimensional analysis. They go kind of, you know, protein conformation, right? If this is the case, what does the fold look like? If I change now that one amino acid, now what the sequence looks like and what the fold looks like. You kind of go back and forth between the levels of analysis, Very interesting. Okay, so I already talked about this, but I'll say it again. So again, ligand is the thing that binds to the protein. The protein has a binding site that's very specific. For example, non-covalent bonds or polar covalent bonds that binds the ligand. And this is the kind of thing that it looks like in vitro, basically. This is a model for what it looks like. Very complicated and well hidden, right? See, this is what we mean by restricting access, right? It's like kind of deep in there, so that really only that particular molecule is going to fit well. This is an example of the kind of things you can see. So when the protein's unfolded, you have these amino acid side chains. When it's folded, all these kind of random-looking side chains that you saw before, right, actually are going into the inside and forming the binding site. So it's really hard to predict this, right? So, if you computationally you look at this and say, oh, wow, it has, glutamine, arginine, whatever, but you don't know until the protein actually folds that they're all inside contributing to the binding interactions. And in real life, this is what it looks like, right? So this is just an example, but you have a serine and an arginine here. Remember, serine are the guys who like, because of the OH group, like to form hydrogen bonds. Arginine, remember, is one of the positively charged. I'm remembering all your memorization for you. Glutamate, same idea. So here you have a positive-negative charge, so that's an electrostatic interaction, so charge-charge interaction, kind of an ionic bond situation. Here you have a hydrogen bond, which is a weak bond due to the polarity of each side. And so what they're binding, this protein is binding, is this cyclic AMP, right? So the cyclic AMP, you notice that all these different molecules everywhere, right? The oxygen, boom, a prime suspect for hydrogen bonding, right? Oxygen here, prime suspect for hydrogen bonding, et cetera, et cetera. Nitrogen group also, easy to have hydrogen bonding here. So basically, when you look at a molecule and you see stuff sticking out, like these kind of phosphate oxygens and the nitrogen groups, nitrogen rings, boom, automatically you think, hydrogen bonding, polar interactions. Yeah. So this is the kind of thing that it actually looks like. Sure, yeah.
So before, it was in contact with the ligand, it's actually not that shape.
Well, it's more or less the shape. So this is after the folding. It's not after binding. So that's kind of a key difference. So when this protein actually folded, it actually already takes kind of the shape. But you are right that it doesn't quite always lock on so well yet, So most of the time when you have a big protein, probably there's a piece, like a subunit where it doesn't quite, it's sitting in there, but it might not be kind of, super tight yet until the molecule comes in. When the molecule comes, it kind of fits like a glove like this. Yeah.
How does these hard, strong hydrogen bonds break so that the protein leaves?
Yeah, So, right, let the molecule go, right?
Yeah.
So you have first, you have water that's forming within these structures, right? So the water, once you kind of displace the water with a molecule, boom, they get in there and lock on. So usually what happens is that, we talk about a specific type of protein called enzymes, which are catalyzing reaction. So most of the time when you catalyze some reaction, after you finish with it, some group changed. You're modifying some group. And when that group changed, then it no longer has this very tight fit. So it kind of boom, boom, modified just a little bit, just enough so that it doesn't quite fit so well anymore, and then it pops back out. Because the water always comes in, right? That's why you have to restrict the access to the water. Because if the water is always there, you can't bind molecules, right? Because molecule comes, goes out. Molecule comes, goes out. But if you're restricting the access to the water just enough, then the molecule comes in, locks on, gets whatever done to it, right? And after it finishes getting whatever is done to it, now it no longer has the same tightness that displaces the water. Now the water is actually going to be able to come in and kind of displace the molecule. So very fine machinery, you know, going on. Great questions. So this is basically what I was saying. So you have hydrogen bonds, and the hydrogen bonds are now in also actually kind of forming not just on one site, right? So here you have this basically histidine module, and then you have aspartate and serine, and these guys are actually kind of locking on to each other. And in one case, actually, you basically what happens is that hydrogen gets absorbed by this very electronegative nitrogen on the same protein, and actually makes it reactive. So in other words, it makes it negatively charged. Whenever you have a negative or positive charged species, it's going to be highly reactive. So what that means is if the molecule comes, it easily kind of, you know, does something to it, right? Because it's very highly charged, you know, very tight interactions. So what that means is that these hydrogen bonding interactions actually can cause the protein within themselves to become kind of positive or negatively charged so that you have additional interactions that are possible. Okay, so protein binding, so there's different types of protein binding. So for example, you have this kind of a loop structure that comes with phosphorylated groups. I'll talk about this later, but basically the idea is that when you need to modify the proteins or the enzymes, usually you do something to it. For example, you add a phosphate group to it. So that's one of the possibilities. So I'll talk about that in a little bit. But the proteins themselves also have kind of very different structure. We talked about actually last time having coil-coil alpha helices binding together. I kind of already talked about this, but you want to have the surface maximized. So in other words, the more bigger the surface that's kind of convoluted in some specific sense, the better, because there's more bonding possibilities. That's very specific also when you have that tight window. People like to also study this in the context of antibodies, because antibodies have these specific sites that actually are also form loops. That it's actually two identical sites, right? The heavy and the light chains. But basically, you know, the idea is the same. Basically, that they bind antigens, which are the guys that they do something to. In this case, antigens are whatever, some disease molecule, you know, something like that you want to bind to. And the antibody binds them to them in that very specific way, kind of some of the stuff we talked about earlier. Okay, so one of the key things I want you guys to be able to understand from this lecture, so actually kind of really the official start of this lecture kind of now, because what I want to talk about is enzyme kinetics, which is basically talking about enzyme function. Now, some of it will be a little bit mathematical. You won't have to understand like every mathematical detail, but you should be able to do simple calculations, okay? And these calculations are all, you can do this in your head. It's not difficult. It's not chemistry. But I would like you to kind of introduce the idea, and then so that you guys can get an idea of what actual work looks like, right? So when you're actually working in a lab looking at the function of a specific enzyme, this is what you do. You put some molecules, whatever substrate you want in there. You measure concentrations of the reactants, the products over time. You look at the slope, et cetera, et cetera, right? Like, so this is what you actually do in lab. So I want you guys to sort of an idea of what the actual study of these guys quantitatively actually look like. Okay, so, well, there might be one other slide in between there, but let me just start now. So equilibrium constant, first of all, everybody kind of know more or less equilibrium constant of a reaction? Basically, it kind of measures, you know, what is happening when you're at steady state in some reaction, right? So it's just described in this volume per unit mole, you know, context. So basically, the simplest way to think about it is you have a, a reaction equation, so then you kind of look at the product over the reactants, basically, in concentration units, and that gives you basically your equilibrium constant. Okay. So this is kind of what I already talked about before, the different types of protein interaction. You have I didn't say this maybe as well as I should, but you have different types of possibilities, like the helix-helix I was talking about, but the two different surfaces binding, like I was saying. So one thing I failed to mention a little bit is the surface and string approach, where you have the surface of the protein, but it's actually kind of binding like one polypeptide chain, something that you want to modify. And actually, this is kind of like Pac-Man-ish, where you kind of grab it and you got and then let it go, kind of. Yeah. So this is, I already talked about, so I'm going to skip this, but this is talking about antibodies and how you have very specific binding with the antigens. Okay. This is kind of what we were talking about before with the specific interactions, is that when you have a very good match between these two different moieties, are you actually going to have this fit. Because when you have the fit, then you have a lot of bonding possibilities. So the stuff in red, basically, right? And these guys are very tight because, you know, they have so many different hydrogen bonding, for example, possibilities, right? And whereas opposed to these two other moieties where there's just not enough for them to have lasting changes, right? So in an enzyme or protein, like, which is D, I guess, in this case, right, that's what you want. You want a very specific fit with lots of possibilities for interactions. Okay, finally we're into more or less about kinetics and enzymes. So first of all, the dissociation rate it's similar to, you know, the equilibrium constant, but in this case it's talking about basically you have some rate of reaction which depends on the reactants, right? So the rate of dissociation is some off constant, right? So the off constant will just, it's indicative of how, in this reaction, how possible is it for these guys to come off, you know, as you're having the reaction take place, right? So anyway, so that multiplied by the concentration of the reactants is giving you the dissociation rate. The association rate is the same idea, right? It's just some other constant times the product of A and B. Why is it the product? Because, well, if A increases, you're more likely to have this association, right? Because you have more A's. If B increases, you're more likely to have this association. If both of them increases, you're even more likely. So that's why it's product of A and B. And this is also why it's just the... So the upper panel, AB, is one thing. It's not A times B. It's AB is the thing that when these guys come together, they form a complex of AB. And this AB is the concentration in which is dependent the actual reaction. The more AB you have, the more likely you're going to have the reaction go forward, right? Because you need in that form. So in the equilibrium, at equilibrium, so what this is what we mean by equilibrium constant. At equilibrium, the rate of going into A plus B and the rate of getting back to AB is the same. That's what it means to be at equilibrium, at steady state. When you equate those and you do equilibrium constant, you do simple algebra, it just turns out to be K on over K off. And this is what I was saying before, it's actually just the ratio of these concentrations. So that's what it means to be at equilibrium. Actually, this is not so important, because actually the important stuff is the next 10, 15, 20 minutes. Okay, just to give you a hint. So enzymes, of course, are proteins that when you take the substrates, it does something to it, and it becomes a product, right? So you can actually write that as an equation, right? So the enzyme plus the substrate, and then they form the enzyme-substrate complex, right? This is kind of the AB thing I was telling you earlier. Because now they're one thing, right? And then whatever happens in the enzyme reaction happens, and the substrate becomes the product. It's still together, right? They haven't separated yet. So that's why it's EP, after you finish. But afterwards, the key exercise is actually when the separation of those two guys. After you don't get along anymore, sayonara, you become E and P. Right? So they kind of re-separate. So the end product is that you have E plus S going into E plus P. Right? That's what you want. Okay. Now, there are a couple of parameters I want to tell you about, about this reaction, right? The model is very simple, but then there's some mathematical details. So Vmax is the rate of reaction when you actually have all your sites fat saturated. What that means is that, so you have lots of enzyme in the solution, right? If all the enzymes are busy working, right, nobody's free. As soon as the substrate comes in, the enzyme works on it, it leaves, substrate comes in. There's no time when the enzymes are free. Now, at equilibrium, of course, there's going to be coming and going, right? It's not like they're exactly all occupied. But, you know, the idea is that they're coming on as soon as, they're ready to come off. So more or less, they're always occupied. So when this is happening, and you measure the rate of reaction, that's the Vmax, right? Very simple, just the maximum rate at which you can, when all the enzymes are active, how fast can this reaction happen? The E plus S, the E two E plus P. Okay. Something that I want you guys to be able to calculate later is turnover number. So turnover number is the maximum rate divided by the enzyme concentration. Why is it called a turnover number? So here's the idea: Vmax is some, you know, volume per unit, right? Per unit time, right? So if you want to measure how well this enzyme is actually turning over the substrate to product, then you divide by the concentration, because of course the bigger the concentration, the faster you're going, right? But if you're normalizing by the concentration, that's giving you an idea of how well kind of this enzyme works on a per mole-ish basis, right? So, yeah.
Just confirm, Vmax is for successful reactions only, not like failed where it binds and like it goes away.
I mean, you don't really think about it that way. So so-called unsuccessful reactions are always happening. So they're always happening. So the Vmax takes into account of that. So your intuition is right. It's taking account of the fact that some of them are binding and releasing without going to, you know, for example, remember this E plus S going to ES, right? Remember that's actually the reaction also going back, ES going to E plus S, right? Remember this? These guys right here? At equilibrium, you have coming in and going off, right? So what that means is that that's actually taking into account the Vmax. The Vmax is what the enzyme is trying to do best, but of course sometimes you have coming in and going off. It doesn't matter. It just means that some enzymes are more tight and some enzymes are not less tight. Right? Then I'll tell you about how you kind of measure the tightness of this enzyme shortly. But anyway, so turnover number though is how well this guy is churning out products, right? So, and that is also symbolized kcat. Okay. Now, we have a different parameter, and this is also important, but it's called Km. And Km, and this is a little bit, you know, just stay with me here. Km is the substrate concentration when you're sitting at half of the maximum velocity. I know it sounds crazy. Why would you? I'll tell you the mathematics behind this. You don't have to understand my derivation of the precise mathematics, but you should know the result, which is, at the end, Km. The Km, it turns out, okay, I'll tell you now and then I'll prove it to you later. The Km turns out to give you a measure of the binding, the tightness of bonding of the enzyme. Okay, I'll tell you why in a second. Okay, but what you know is that when you have a low Km, it actually means that the enzyme has very tight binding. And when you have a high Km, it has weak binding. And you're going to be able to see it on the curve that I'll show you. Okay? And the way you define it is, in order to get this property, is that Km is the substrate concentration at which you're sitting at half the maximum velocity. Okay. Basically, when you plot the velocity curves, you're going to see what I'm talking about. I'll show you in a second. The next is not so important, but it's just saying that, you know, you have a lot of times in these enzymes, you have actually increases in the local concentration of a substrate, and that kind of, you know, basically the Vmax is not always kind of uniform everywhere. It's just that you're measuring, averaging across the whole beaker, basically. Now, what the enzyme is actually doing, this is actually important, but the enzyme is actually doing is it's lowering the activation energy to go into the transition state. So, I'm glad I can actually use the blackboard, but there's no actual. I should be prepared for the.
It should be under the erasers.
Oh, here? Oh, great. Thanks, guys. So, finally. So hopefully you guys can sort of see what's going on. But basically, when you have a reaction, the free energy actually goes up like this into this. Right? You guys kind of heard of it before, where you have, you know, basically you're looking. Well, this is a G, and then you're looking at the this is the delta G. This is the delta G. This is the delta G, right? And then, so what happens in this reaction is that normally it takes going up a little bit because you need to get to a transition state that is not favorable before you go down to the final state, right? So what enzymes do is actually they change the kind of activation energy, right? They don't change delta G. They don't, you know, the reaction is either going to go forward or not. That doesn't change. They actually just change these guys. That's what enzymes do. Okay, so if it, hopefully that makes sense.
Lefty?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what enzymes actually do. And then what they do is also they can act both as acids and bases, right? So, and that kind of makes sense, right? Because you have many moieties inside there, right? You have positive charges and negative charges, which means there's going to be proton donors and proton acceptors in there. And so the binding side of the enzyme is kind of highly, you know, variable. It can do both things. In fact, you can even do the same thing like from two sides at the same time, right? So that's also a characteristic of the enzyme. Sure. Sure.
Okay. Why is it? It is not related to the concentration of the enzyme.
Okay. The reason, I'm going to show you actually in a slide later, but the reason is the Km actually tells you about how steep your curve with respect to kind of your velocity of reaction with respect to the substrate concentration, basically. So it's not a property, it's irrespective of the enzyme concentration, basically. It's something that defines the enzyme in some sense. Like, every enzyme kind of has some characteristic kind of, you know, tightness of binding, basically. But yeah, anyways. Yeah.
If the concentration of the enzyme is really high, it also needs a higher concentration of
No, if the enzyme concentration is high, then your Vmax is going to be higher. That's true. So if the Vmax is higher, then it's gonna change the substrate concentration at which you have the Vmax. So it does change with respect. It's a characteristic of the reaction. Let's just say that. It's a characteristic of the reaction. But the turnover number is the characteristic of the enzyme. Sorry, maybe I said that wrong before, but the Km is a characteristic of the reaction, but it's telling you whether this reaction is tightly bound binding or weakly binding. And the reason is because, I will show you in the slide later, is because it's measuring the velocity with respect to substrate concentration. And this, you know, okay, I'll get there. It's a little bit confusing. So let me there are a bunch of types of enzymes. Actually, I'm going to skip this slide because we're going to talk about most of these. So, you know, I think the important ones here are, for example, ligases, which are basically the kind of connect adjacent nucleic acids together in DNA replication, and kinases and phosphatases. So those are very important because kinases actually put on phosphate groups to different molecules, and actually phosphatases take them out. Right? So most of the time they think of them as kinases activating something and phosphatases deactivate, but it doesn't necessarily mean the case. You can also activate by dephosphorylating. Okay. All right, so this is kind of what I'm going to get to, but this is a picture of what it looks like. So when the substrate concentration is high, then obviously you're going to have higher velocity, right? I mean, because you know there's more substrates to work with. But you only have a certain number of enzymes. So what that means is that when you increase it above a certain point, you know, in this case, somewhere over here, you're not getting that much more because all the enzymes are already saturated, right? So the theoretical limit at which, you know, all the enzymes are saturated, in other words, when substrate concentration is at infinity, is the Vmax of this reaction, this particular concentration of enzymes that you have. And when you're sitting at half of Vmax, that's your Km. That's the substrate concentration at which you're sitting at half of the Vmax. Okay? But you can kind of already see from this curve, without the mathematics, why we talk about tightness versus not tight, right? Because think about it. When Km is low, right, that means as soon as you put a little bit of substrate in, boom, reaction goes up the roof. Right, so are people seeing this? Maybe I need to actually draw that. So, don't need this anymore. So this curve, so imagine this curve that is on there, right? A situation where you have something like this, and you have a situation of something like this, right? So, again, half Vmax, right? So you're either here, or you're something like here, right? Because these guys all have the same Vmax, right? It's the same reaction, more or less. It's just different speed to get there, right? So, for example, this could be one enzyme versus a different enzyme, right? But you notice when this Km is small, this is why I was saying what I said earlier, when the Km is small, as soon as you put a little bit of substrate in, boom, the enzyme works well, close to, I mean, at Vmax earlier than you need to be. You don't need to put that much substrate in order to get the same half of Vmax, right? So that means it's tightly binding. Yeah?
Confusion about the notation.
Sure.
M, like the K used previously for equilibrium constant is a constant, so like moles per decimeters per second. Or wait.
Which ones are you talking about?
Okay, the Km we have right over here, substrate concentration,
yeah.
Units for that are moles per decimeter cubed.
Yeah, it's basically just concentration
moles.
Units.
But that, is that the same
volume per mole?
Is that the same capital K used for like dissociation equilibrium?
They're all kind of different. They're all the units depend on how you write them out. So equilibrium constant is unitless, right? Because
okay.
You know, or I guess sorry. I take that back. In this reaction, it's not unitless because there's more products than the reactants. So it kind of depends on that, right? So therefore, you have inverse volume, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But the one for Km we talk about, though, is always just concentration units because it's defined as a substrate concentration, right? Is that okay for people? So concentration units. So, you know, milliliter, whatever, microliter, most likely, right? Microliter, you know, of Km.
And like, what's number-wise? What's large?
I mean,
what order of magnitude are we speaking about?
It depends on the volume of enzymes you put in, so it's not so set, right? I mean, it depends on the reaction, how much of the reaction you're doing. So, when you looked at the turnover numbers, there you have I don't know the answer, but there you have some specific usual numbers for them, because you're normalized by the enzyme volume, and there you have concentration, and there you have kind of characteristics about, oh, this enzyme is about this number. But here it depends on the reaction, so it depends on how much stuff you put in there, it depends on the substrate concentration, so it's not so right.
So these graphs are individual for every individual
reaction.
Separate, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a bit confused about the turnover number, like what is that, does it take into consideration the time also, or like, is it just thing produces that much per...
Yeah, so remember, it's just Vmax divided by enzyme concentration. So you find this Vmax this way, right? So for example, one thing you could do is you could put in some amount of substrate and measure the rate of reaction, right? Now, if you know that you're sitting at Km, you just put, that's the amount of substrate that you have in there, then you know what the Vmax would be, right? So from the Vmax, you can actually calculate the turnover number. You see what I'm saying? Like, you don't have to, it's not something where you have to put infinite amount of enzyme, and then, you're kind of using the mathematics by using different concentrations, measuring the rate of reaction, postulating the curve at which this would happen, and then calculating based on that. Now, later on, I will also show you a way to kind of linearize this process. So in this case, if you put in different substrate concentrations and you measure the rate of reaction, well, a lot of them are going to sit over here. It's going to be hard to see this curve. So a lot of times what happens is people do a slightly different process where they're doing it linearly. You don't have to understand particularly that process, but I'll show you how this is done.
Wait, Vmax is a rate, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's over time, right? Like, how does...
Yeah, so that's the part... Okay, the Vmax is some characteristic of this reaction, particularly. Like, when you have that much stuff in there, that... The Vmax will characterize the maximum rate of this reaction. You see what I'm saying? If you put infinite amount of concentration, it will sit at Vmax. But it's not like a... It's only time in the sense that you're calculating this, using, this is the product I see divided by time. But it's just a characteristic of the reaction. It's not a... I think you're trying to get at whether it itself needs to be combined with other kind of time information, but it's not... Yeah, like you can actually measure this, right, by just looking at the product over time, for example, right? Yeah. Okay. Good, very good. These are all good questions. So I already talked about this a little bit, but this is what the enzyme actually does. So if you have an uncatalyzed reaction, you have the A scenario here. You got to get to a very high energy transition state, and that's less favorable, right? But if you have an enzyme, then what happens is that it reduces the need to go into the this hump, this transition state. So let me just say, this T right here is the transition state, right? So actually, this curve actually even shows it better, because it's saying that it's actually lowering the temporary energy, the activation energy, so that you're going into a well slightly before you go up. Actually, so it actually kind of stabilizes the transition state in the sense that it wants to actually get there more easily. Yeah. Okay. So this is just kind of, I was saying that enzymes could do both acid and base catalysis. That's basically it. It's not a big deal. Okay, so I know there's a little bit of math here, but I'll try to. This stuff you don't have to know, like, the exact derivation or anything, but it kind of is satisfying for you to know it. But you should kind of know the result of what's going on. So I'm just kind of step by step here. So this reaction is the reaction that you're looking at. You're going E plus S, and then you have some constant that's going to the ES, and some off constant that's going back back into E plus S. Right? This is the kind of the association and disassociation constants I tell you earlier. Now, the actual catalysis of this, right, is actually ES going to EP and then EP dissociating into E plus P, right? So, so I guess there's a minor assumption here where the EP and the E plus P is kind of, they're grouping it into kind of one thing. Now, the velocity is actually just defined as the K cat times the ES concentration. Why is that? Because the bigger the ES concentration, the bigger the velocity, because the more enzyme-substrate complexes you have, right? And K-cat is the turnover number that we talked about earlier, because think about it, it's just velocity divided by some concentration. In this case, it's enzyme concentration, right? Okay, so so in the typical reaction, this is what actually happens, right? So the ES kind of increases over time. So now we're looking at time. So that's the asking point. This is concentration, okay? So maybe this is a part of the confusion. But in this graph, it's looking at time. This is when the reaction actually happens, right? So you actually measure velocity based on this. And actually, in this case, they're actually showing concentrations also in this on the y-axis. But anyways, the important thing is that as the time goes on, more, you know, you have a lot of free enzymes initially, right? And then as the kind of substrates come in, they bind to the substrate, and then you have a lot more of the enzyme-substrate complex comparing to enzyme, right? That's why it's increasing. But eventually, it kind of steady states out, right? Because most of these guys are filled, and once it's filled, some of them come off, some of them come in, some of them come off, some of them come in. Then actually you can, and they show that by this kind of slight reduction over time. But basically, you get to some steady state level at which a majority of the enzymes are occupied, and it's coming off as soon as you're coming on. And that is the characteristic of the enzyme binding site, how well it's actually binding to. Okay. Now, here's the mathematics. So if you guys want to go to sleep, this is not the time to do it, but but if you're not mathematically inclined, I totally understand. Okay, so as studies, maybe this is not so super important.
Skip. Next slide.
I mean, but then some of you are very mathematical oriented, so I'm kind of debating whether I, you don't think so?
Nah.
I mean, this is... I mean, yeah. So the basic idea is that at steady state, right, the enzyme substrate concentration is basically the same, because you have coming in is the same as going off, right? The on and off rates are about the same. So what you do is you just set these equations equal. That's all it is, right? K minus 1 times ES, that's dissociation, right? Plus the catalysis, right? So they're either going to dissociate or they're going to catalyze. Those are the only two things that can happen from ES. And you set that equal to the rate at which they form. So this is kind of ignoring the product side, right? That once it becomes a product, it doesn't come back. That's kind of the, you know, that's the assumption. But basically, the math is very simple. You just set this equal at steady state, right? So this is just saying, okay, now what's going on at steady state? And once you do that, then it's just a bunch of rearrangements. You define the Km this way. So the Km is defined as coming off plus the turnover divided by coming on, right? If you define it that way, then you get this equation, okay? The equation says ES, which is the concentration of that complex, is now equal to some overall level of enzyme times the substrate. So more substrate, the more you have the enzyme-substrate complex, right? And the more enzyme you start with, the more enzyme-substrate complex you have, right? Right? More or less. But it's modified by this Km. So that what that means is that this curve will now look sigmoid, like I was saying. Right? This is just, that's all it means. Now, when you actually define this V like we did before, so the velocity is when you're at the enzyme substrate concentration times turnover, right? So this is just the definition of the turnover, remember. this equation here is the definition of turnover. Velocity equals that constant times the enzyme substrate complex concentration. Right? Because velocity divided by concentration of enzyme is how well you're turning them over. Right? So that definition gives you the velocity. So if you plug in velocity here, then velocity gives you this guy. And that's exactly what we were finding earlier. This curve is a description of the velocity. Right? And actually, if you notice here, when you plug in, it's not stated here, but if you plug in Vmax, so basically you plug in the concentration at which you're getting Vmax over 2, you can actually figure it out from the equation what each of those individual things are, what the velocity is, right? At, you know, half, you know, anyways. So what is stated here is that it's kind of like intuition. It's just that when you have the substrate concentration going higher and higher, almost all the enzyme will be at the substrate complex level. And in that case, V becomes Vmax, because if most of those guys are bound, then that means they're churning out products as fast as they can, right? So at that level, V becomes the Vmax. So that's why, in this case, E0, which is the overall amount of enzyme, times the kcat becomes the Vmax, right? So you can actually find velocity based on the Vmax and the Km, right? So what happens is actually, so this is the equation that kind of governs enzyme kinetics. I know I didn't go over every single detail with you, but the curve is understandable, right? If you guys understand what this curve is saying, right, then you're set, right? Because, so let me go back to that. So because this is what we just defined, all that stuff we did with the math, right, was just to come up with a relationship of the concentration with rate of reaction. That's all it was. That curve is just telling you that mathematical equation is just telling you that it's going to look like a sigmoid shape when you actually derive it. Okay? So, now, once you have this equation, actually most people, what they do is they like to linearize it. I'm not going to go over the process because we don't have time to do it. But, so this is what it is. So remember, you don't have to know the linearization part of this. But the one on the left is clear, right? The one on the left is this. And the way we derive it, remember, is the right side here, right? We set at steady state, you're going to have as much guys coming in as going out into the enzyme substrate complex. You set those equal, you do the algebra, blah, 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 and you come up with a relationship relating the velocity to the substrate concentration. Because you have some constant times the S on top divided by some other constant plus some S, that shape, if you plot this equation in your graphing calculator, I know which we don't use anymore, but MATLAB, whatever, it's a sigmoid shape. That's all it's saying. But once you have that, right, this is an additional level that some of you would, you know, just for your own interest, is that once you have the V versus the S relationship, which makes sense, right, because as soon as you add more and more substrate, you have velocity increase, which is characterized by this constant in terms of how tight it is, okay? But once you have that, you can also kind of basically divide both sides, right? So when you do 1 over V on both sides of the equation that I showed you earlier, this is what the equation now looks like. Okay, so this equation, 1 over both sides, basically, right? I mean, it's very clear, right? Because that becomes Km over Vmax S, and then S over Vmax S, then you have 1 over V, right? Vmax, right? So when you actually look at that, now you get this other equation, which is actually much easier to work with if you're in lab. Because in this case, what you do is you just figure out what the 1 over Vs are, right? And then you figure out what the 1 over S's are. You plot them, and it's linear. If it's linear, then you can calculate the slope. Well, the slope is just this guy, right? Vm over Vmax. So that means you have a very clear you know, you can have a very clear way to calculate these parameters, right? And yeah, also, I mean, you can also look at the x and y intercepts, right? Actually, the easiest thing is actually look at the y intercepts first, because that gives you Vmax already. If you have the Vmax, you can get the Km from the slope. So, you see what I'm saying? So, if you don't understand, it's okay. But the idea is very simple. It's just that the guy on the left is what you have to know. Okay, the guy on the left is what you have to know. When you increase the substrate concentration, usually the reaction increases in this kind of sigmoidal type. Why is that? Because when you have more substrates initially, all the enzymes are free, so it's going to be more quick, right? It's going to gobble up all the substrate, and the rate of reaction initially is going to be fast, right? Initially in the sense of in respect to the substrate concentration. But when you add more and more substrate, the enzymes are already saturated, so you're sitting on the right side of this curve. Well, in that case, not going to change the rate of reaction as much. And if you understand this, this is then you're ready, set to go. Which is, you know, this is saying that shape of that curve is a characteristic of this reaction, and in turn, because of the way these guys are calculated, different enzymes will give you different curves. Okay, but this reaction now is saying that when you have a different situation, you have, for example, a different enzyme that's doing the same reaction, for example, and you can measure these curves, then that Km, which is the concentration at half of your Vmax, is going to vary between the reactions. When it's over here, it's very tight. When tight just means when the substrate comes in, the enzymes bind to them and react very simply. When it's over here, that means you need more substrates basically to get to the same half Vmax. And so that's all it means. That's why it's less tight. Okay, so if you guys understand this, is everybody okay understanding this curve? Everybody's okay with this curve. End of lecture. That's it. Seriously, like this is the thing. If you understand this, like this curve, this lecture. If you understand this unlabeled graph, which I will label now, and yeah, that's basically the idea. Is that this curve measuring tightness of this reaction? Yeah.
I'm nitpicking here.
Sure.
Why are the test tube colors go darker if the saturation, if the substrate concentration okay. increases?
I think they're actually talking about here is that there's they're talking about more products, I guess. So if you have more products, then you have kind of more green left over. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Yeah,
it's a
sense
of disbelief, yeah.
Yeah. So basically they're kind of trying to mimic the lab situation in which, you know, hopefully you see more products that are of a certain color. And interesting, if you look at the reciprocal curve, right, it's actually reversed.
No way.
Yeah. Okay, anyways. I know we kind of talked about this, but I'll just, you know, because I didn't go over as much detail as I thought I would, but it's okay. So you define Km in this particular way, and the reason you define this way is because of the way the equation works out, okay? And then the important thing really is just V equals Kcat ES thing, right? Because that's the definition of your Kcat, the turnover number, okay? The turnover number is the velocity divided by the enzyme concentration. So that's what it is, and you substitute that into there. And this actually, this whole slide, if you guys are interested afterwards, is my way of writing the derivation. This is probably the clearest way I can write down the derivation. Because if you define this, then Km ES equals that thing. That's just that steady state constraint. And then you just go in there and do the math, right? I actually write all this out here. And you know, there's a couple of things to kind of realize. One is when the S is really big, then in this equation, okay, maybe I don't have time to go, just a little quick. When the S is really big, then you notice that the Km is much smaller than the S, right? So you can kind of ignore that S term basically. And then you get a linear relationship of the V, right? So if you have that guy being very big, then that guy, sorry, this equation here, right? These guys all cancel out, and V just equals V max, right? So you see that? So anyway, so but that just gives you a fine way of visual, you know, understanding that mathematically, because that last note, that not a last notice here, it's very easy to see here, right? When S is big, V is close to V max. This is just a mathematical way of actually writing that down. Okay, so I think I need to actually, because we're just gonna, I spent a lot of time on this. So, how much of this I want to go into? I kind of talked about this already, right? Small km means you have this, you know, tighter binding, you know, kind of steeper binding curve. There's a lot of things you can do with the mathematics, right? So you can basically do different calculations by assuming different things. For example, when the k-cat is small, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Km is in concentration units. That's important, but I already kind of told you about that. And this 1 over S, 1 over V, this is just telling you how to calculate things once you have that in the reciprocal plot relationship. So and then the k-cat and the km gives you a rate constant for the reaction, and then it's telling you how well this enzyme is actually acting. And in particular, because KM is going to be different for different particular reaction, the K-cat will give you a parameter of the enzyme. It's telling you how well the enzyme is turning over. Okay. So as an example, you have this thing called the lysozyme. I can go a little bit. Okay. So again, the activation energy is really high when you're trying to like kind of cleave polysaccharides. So polysaccharides are just a bunch of sugars linked together. Sometimes you want to take individual sugars and use them for energy, for example. So lysozyme is one of those things that does that by hydrolysis to break these guys apart, right? Not to use them yet, but just to break them apart. So these are just examples, but they have these long grooves that hold these sugars together, and it does the cut. So actually, if you remember that slide I had earlier with the string and the surface that I said I skipped, that's actually what the lysozyme actually looks like. I mean, some of this is just detail. It's saying that there's an aspartate group that's basically covalently bonded to one of the carbons, and when it does that, the other side comes in and attacks the other oxygen. Okay, let me just show you. It's a little bit complicated, but you don't have to know all the details. So this first is the it's a basic reaction. This one you can understand, right? So the substrate comes in, I'm this guy that gobbles up. It's kind of the Pac-Man that takes the middle, you know, whatever thing. Yeah, the middle cube. It goes in the middle, it makes it easier to get to that intermediate state. And once it's at the intermediate state, it breaks it apart, ES going to EP, and then it floats apart. That's what the lysozyme looks like. It uses these conformation strategies in the sense that the reason why that ES thing is now more stable is because this particular conformation of the lysozyme binds it in such a way to make it more favorable for it to bind in that way. Okay. So in terms of biochemistry, this you don't really have to know, but in case you're interested to read this later, that's the way it works. It has this. So here's the thing. The GLU35 and the aspartate 52 are giving you the position in the enzyme that's doing something. So it's in the number 35 position somewhere. It's doing something. But anyway, the key is that glutamate comes in. And remember, this is going to be hydrogen bond possibilities, right? Polar interactions, right? You have the hydrogen sticking out. You have the oxygen sticking out. Boom, it goes and attacks it. When it attacks it, it helps to form this covalent bonding situation with the aspartate. See? Because once it attacks this oxygen, now this carbon is more free to do covalent bond type things. And because this aspartate is charged, it very likely does a covalent bond with them. Right? And once it does that, then actually the next part of the reaction is you have a water coming in. The water comes in, and because of the way that this glutamate now has a positive minus charge, the water likely is going to come in here and form the alcohol group. And when it does that, it changes the conformation. The conformation now allows the water to come into this carbon one. You see that? It's because that glutamate now changed. It goes out of the way. Now you don't have restricted access to water anymore. Okay, this is all the stuff we kind of already talked about, kind of put into one kind of summarized example reaction. Okay, you don't have to know the detail of this reaction, but you should know, oh, this is the way things work, right? Like, kind of, wow, you have a lot of charges interacting with each other. You have more than one moiety, and they work kind of in combination to restrict access to water, to allow water in, hydrogen bonding, all kinds of covalent interaction. This is the way the enzymes actually work in the actual in vivo. Okay. So these are kind of just different types of enzyme interactions that are possible. I'm a little bit late. It's okay. We have Saturday, all day Saturday to work out everything. I'm just kidding. So yeah, this is the hot dog configuration. You have the blue and the, you know, basically these are different types of interactions you have. So the middle one is simplest because you have charge-charge interactions, right? It's going to bind specifically to these particular sausages that have positive on one side, negative on the other side, right? And then you can also force this guy to go to kind of more transition state because of the shape of the molecule. It likes to kind of bend it in that way. Boom, it goes to transition state more easily. Yeah. Okay, no more hot dog buns. So enzymes often they need other things in addition to what's in the body. So for example, rhodopsin, which is something in the eye that actually detects light, basically. You need vitamin A, so you just can't natively produce vitamin A. You actually have to eat it. Like, this is why you guys, like thin girls, you have to eat. You actually have to eat. You can't just not eat. Okay, sorry. That was completely random. Yeah. Iron. This is why you need iron, right? Hemoglobin needs iron. You can't just have iron. You actually need to function with something that's outside the body.
This actually never satisfied me. So we learned in the lab previously that like we have to measure iron concentrations in water because too much iron is toxic, builds up and kills you whatsoever.
Yeah.
But you have to eat it to survive, so...
Well, you don't have to have too much of it, right? You're going to toxify it if you have too much of it. But yes, you do need iron. So this is why people take iron as a vitamin, actually.
So why do people take iron supplements, for instance, if their water already has iron?
It depends on their metabolism, right? So some people, for instance, they have a deficit in the hemoglobin, right? There's a certain configuration, exactly, anemia, where they're not able to bind oxygen as well, and you imagine that's a big problem, right? Because they go up some stairs and it's like the brain freezes. Right? Oh shit! You know, so you need sometimes you need more iron, and it depends on you know where you are. Yeah. So, but it does mean but the body does get rid of extra stuff. That does too. So, and actually, if you're taking a good diet, you shouldn't have to take extra iron. Like if you're eating broccoli and, you know, cabbage, whatever. That's in there. It's in, I mean, the one that has it a lot is the spinach. You know Pai Pai? You guys know Pai Pai? He takes spinach?
Do you look American?
Yeah, Pai Pai. Right? So that spinach has shitload of iron. That's why Pai Pai is like, whoa, look at my muscles full of oxygen. Like, all this oxygen running through my blood, you know? I really have to move on. Right? Okay, so, you know, things like biotin, that's also essential, you know, and actually you have to eat that. Okay, so the enzymes are actually limited by kind of diffusion in some sense, right? Because a lot of times, if the substrate's there, it's probably going to bind. It's pretty tight most of the time. So what that means is that it just depends on how well the guys can diffuse to you. So what that means is that you can actually help your reaction along by having kind of constrained compartments, right? So the first thing I talk about is molecular tunnels, right? So there you have active sites are connected together, either on the same protein or different enzymes or the different ones. The reason you want that is because now, once you capture one substrate, you don't release it and then wait for it to drop by diffusion to bind it again. It kind of tunnels. So what that means is that once it grabs a substrate, boom, it does one thing, and then it does the next thing in concert with the next part. So that speeds up the reaction because it gets rid of that extra kind of having to diffuse around kind of step, right? And that's kind of the same idea with the multi-enzyme complexes, right? So basically, molecular tunnel, if you think of it as the case where you have a lot of them together. So all of a sudden transform into like Star Wars. You have like one enzyme, boom, bum, 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 many, many complexes gathered together, right? And then you go just boom, one after another, just like a factory of these guys, just churning out clones. Boom, one clone, boom, next clone. That's kind of what these big complexes. So it's kind of a culmination of that idea, of that strategy. But the other one that's different is the segregation. So instead of having what I was just saying, which is tunneling one enzyme to another, basically, one site to another, you can also just limit where your reaction takes place. So for example, if you're in the ER, for example, you have in the vesicle, then, you know, without the vesicle, you wait for the substrate. Oh, when is it coming? You know, it's just going to diffuse from outside the membrane somewhere. Oh, wait, I got one, right? Instead of doing that, you concentrate all your molecule substrates into this little vesicle. Once in the vesicle, boom, the enzyme comes in, and then blah, 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 right, does everything. So that also basically is a way to limit, to decrease the effect of diffusion.
Tunnel is not an ion canal, per se.
No, that's a completely different thing. The ion canal is just it's a protein that allows certain ions to flow. Yeah. Okay, so this is vitamin A, this is hemoglobin. Okay, so I don't have time to talk about it. This is an example of a complex, basically. It goes, you know, it comes in, and then it does stuff, and then it releases. Okay. Here's your question. Actually, these are more tricky, so I give you guys some time to kind of work it out.
You wouldn't have to take roll if you don't want to. But
I would also need to take... Shit, I didn't think that. Okay. I would let you guys think about this, and then as you keep thinking, I take roll, okay? So first read it, and then, you know, really think about it first. I give you guys music too. What's good music for you to study? How about
not what you have on your iPod?
How about American music? I give you guys American music. If it's working.
Fly me to the moon.
So pen and paper out. You guys know how to do this calculation. If you understood my lecture, you should be able to keep it up. You guys have all the information. I can take roll. I think I can take roll at the same time. Anyways. So, yeah. It's okay.
up to.
Yeah.
That.
Yay! Works for one more week. Wee Hong. Not here. Daiki. Not here. He was here.
Get back to him when he comes in, if he comes in.
Okay. Then. Mark is here. Young. I don't remember actually. Young Wu. No, not here. Don't remember. Shen is here, right? Yes. Jing Yi. Okay. Chi is here. Rachel here. Han here. Yurina? Okay.
Yeah, he wasn't here when you said his name, so.
Daiki, you're here? Okay. Yeah. Daiki. Kion is not here.
He's never gonna come.
Jinhee?
Yeah,
he's here.
A week.
Christopher? Here. Vin is here. Elise is here. Ellen is here. Okay. Okay.
No.
Oh, sorry. So look at the right column. Make sure it's right. If you're not, well, make sure it's zero that you. It's right.
Yeah, I disagree with some of the ones there.
So you're not really here. You just pretend to be here. Okay. All right. That's it. We just leave this music on. Okay. How are we doing? By the way, people who get it right.
What?
From Chicago. Okay.
Chicago.
Additional motivation.
How condescending.
This is so much fun. Okay, who wants to answer? So fast, this guy. Now that there's candy involved. Okay, tell me the reasoning and then tell me the answer.
Okay, so number one, I think it's C because I did a lot of math and I'm pretty sure my orders. So, first off, it says your KM is 100 millimoles. Right?
Yes.
Bottom line. Double that. Sorry, and the corresponding rate is 500 micromoles per second.
That's right.
Double that, you get 1,000 micromoles per second, which gives you your VM max.
Right, yes. That's fine.
Yes.
That's correct.
Now that you have VM max, you have to divide that by the enzyme concentration.
Yes.
So 1,000.
You're at 1,000 right now. Yeah.
Divided by 10 micromoles.
Yeah.
And assuming the math is correct, I get 1,000.
Wait, 1,000 divided by 10 is 1,000? I don't think the math is correct.
1,000 times 10 divided by negative 6 over 10 to the negative
3. There's no complication.
10 to the negative 3rd over 10 to the negative 6.
Somebody else have an idea?
How many zeros am I off by?
You're overthinking it.
You got three choices.
All right, who wants to? Is anybody? I mean, he basically got the idea. He basically got here. You can have the idea. Here. Okay. So the basic idea is: does anybody also want to just say that more? Way.
Can I have a calculator to correct me?
Anybody? It's okay. This is no. Nobody wants to say anything. Free candy.
Isn't it just what's rounded over?
Right, but just tell me why. Tell me how did you get there?
It's the V max over the enzyme concentration, and the V max is like 2 times 500.
Yeah. Okay. So why is the V max 2 times 500?
Well, because the KM is. Is the substrate constant at 0.5
dm. Right.
And since there's a massive contains like 100 milli m concentration of the substrate.
Right.
So, I think it's 100.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, everybody get that? There you go. Catch. Oh, so close. Okay. So exactly, that's, so exactly, you guys, basically you guys all got it in that sense. So basically you said that the key here is to realize, right? So when this guy's doing, this girl is doing this reaction, basically she's doing the following. She's saying, well, I know that KM for this particular enzyme reaction is 100 millimoles. So somebody worked it out before, there was some table. But when she does this, when she has exactly 100 millimolar of substrate, she can actually calculate some specific amount of enzyme she put in. She calculated that the reaction is the following. But we know that that rate of reaction is V max over 2 because she's sitting at the concentration at which Km is, right? All right, this is just the definition. So does anybody not get that part of it? That's the key thing, yeah?
Sorry, I'm just missing.
Yeah.
Where do we link that the 500 is at Km?
No, so, okay, so the Km for this...
he added Km, yeah.
Yeah, so Km is 100 millimole. That's just a given, okay? But this reaction takes place at 100 millimolar of the concentration substrate.
Okay.
So that must be the concentration at which you're sitting at Emax over 2, because by definition, Km is the substrate concentration at which you get Emax over 2 as your rate of reaction. Is that better? Who's not getting it? I know it's tricky, but... You guys get this? So Km is given, right?
Yeah, Km is given.
But the thing is, she's designed this reaction to exactly do it at Km.
Oh.
Basically, I mean, she didn't design it, but in this question, this, because in this 100 millimolar concentration of substrate, right, she adds some specific amount of enzyme.
Point there would make more sense.
Point here?
Yeah.
No, I want to point here. Let me use this thing. So the reaction is taking place at Km, but Km we know is the concentration at which you're at Vmax over 2, right? That is by definition of Km. So therefore, this reaction rate has to be Vx over 2. And this is what Christopher and Bill were saying. Well, if this thing is Vmax over 2, then Vmax is just 1,000. That's all it is. And then you just say, well, if Vmax is 1,000, you divide by the enzyme concentration of 10. They're both at micromolar per second. You get 100. Right. What about the second one? More candy. It's an easier one. Anybody?
So the person who eliminated an option.
Oh, wow. Then we're giving away a lot of candy.
I'm still picky.
That's fine. Anybody give me, eliminate two of them for me.
Damn, this is hard.
Free candy.
Really?
Come on, anybody.
If you give me three, I can juggle them.
No. you already got one. Well, just eliminate some for me.
Oh, okay.
Tell me what are not right for sure.
A does happen, so...
Well, explain, you know, like...
You showed us the slide.
Yeah, you showed us the slide.
Right, but explain, just tell me, just say it in words.
Like serine groups can donate...
Okay. All right, acid and bases, they can. Here we go. They can have acid and bases, right? So we already talked about that. What about B?
What do you mean by affinity, though? Like, can you define that word?
Affinity is just
tendency towards
it. Yeah, exactly. Okay. I mean, it's great. Okay, anybody else? What about B?
Like, that's not true.
What about C?
That's how enzymes work. That is how enzymes work.
Okay. Who wants candy? Who wants to raise their who wants to raise their hands?
Just raise your hand and you throw it at the person.
Nobody wants candy. You already got one.
Because it has a higher tendency for it to finish, to break.
Because once it is the 20th state, molecules,
what molecules can come in? Which one are you talking about? Hmm? You're talking about B, right? Hmm. Okay. So, okay, let's eliminate more of them. Okay, let's. You go like Yi.
It happens. You show us a picture.
Right, that's the picture with the thing, right?
It's like when this train happens, that's when water flows in. So, okay.
So that can happen. C, you guys all agree can happen. So who wants candy? Nobody wants candy. Okay, now B and D. Okay, somebody dissociate these two for me.
So transition state is ES, right?
Transition state is, you know, you waste it, but it's going, well, yeah, basically.
Yes.
It's going to that.
Yes.
Right.
So the final state is just P. Just product.
Yeah, you can say that. You can say that.
E plus B.
Right, right.
E plus B.
Yeah.
So the reaction is accelerated when ES tends towards E plus B. Like, the arrow is that way, towards E plus S. That's what D is.
Well, the arrow is always going in that direction.
Yeah.
But
accelerating the rate makes it go faster.
Exactly.
That's what D is saying. B, on the other hand, is saying that the arrow is going in the wrong direction. It has higher pain towards the E.
No. It's not saying that. It's saying that
the arrow is
it's more likely to get to the transition state now because the transition state is now being made in a more stable way. Because remember that graph I showed you where it's more easy to get to the transition state, right?
Because the activation energy would be different.
Exactly. So given what I said, anybody? What about B? Is B right or wrong?
Does it happen or is it
federal?
Oh no, sorry.
Energy compared to.
So B is right because it's not the answer to this question, but it's still right because you are getting. You know, you are trying to stabilize the transition state. So if you're getting more better affinity to going to the transition state, that's what you want. But D is saying that you're destabilizing the transition. That doesn't make any sense. It's accelerating the reaction, but it's not, in fact, it's not even doing this, right? Because the transition state needs to be stabilized, not destabilized.
Can you go back to the energy EA diagram?
Sure.
There we go.
Yeah.
EST is transition state.
Right.
EP is the fine, like a.
I mean, that question is not exactly just this, but it can relate to any reaction more or less. But that's the idea.
The stabilizing the transition state means that ES dip after the.
No. It just means that if you destabilize, you're less likely to get to it. If you're stabilized, actually, you're more likely to get to it. You get it? Because if it's.
What part of the diagram refers to transition state?
Transition state is this.
EST.
Right.
So lowering the activation energy for the transition state is the destabilization.
It's not destabilization, it's stabilization. Think about it. You're
English too hard, I understand.
Okay. You understand? No. But here's the thing.
Understand.
You want to get to a transition state that's more likely, right? So if you want to get to it, you don't destabilize. You get to a more stabilized form of it. Yeah. Okay, so. I know. It's okay, I need to get to the answer. So, yeah, you say? You want candy? Here.
So even though EST is higher in energy compared to the ES, it's still more stable compared to the original reaction.
Yeah, it's more, so here's the thing, like, you don't have to think about that too much, but the idea is just that you want to get to a state that's at some end, right? Now, to get to that state, you have to go through some very unstable, kind of hard-to-get-to state in order to get there, right? Because you have to put in energy to get to some crazy, unstable state. But now enzymes are actually saying that, well, I don't need to get to super unstable, I just need to get slightly there. So in other words, I make it more likely to get to the transition state. And it does that by having a specific confirmation that now makes it easier to get to that somewhat unlikely state.
So that state is not that stable, because if you're higher in energy, it has to go
right. But that you can't do too much with the reaction, right? Because if your enzyme can go, you can take that transition state to be even or something like that, then all the reactions will happen spontaneously anyways. You don't need enzymes. Yeah.
Chemistry.
With all those dips,
yeah.
Like, why don't any of them stay stuck in that dip?
Ah, that's a good question, yeah. So basically there are actually a lot of local dips everywhere. So when it gets to, so for example, I guess I can go back to this slide. So remember this reaction, right, that I show you, where some guys come in, blah, blah, blah. Each individually actually has dips in it because, you know, when it forms a certain covalent bond or whatever, it's getting to that, you know, there's aspartate with the CO bond, it's getting to a local dip. And it's like a little bit more, and then go down, you know, that kind of thing. So really the enzyme is not, you know, it's not doing this big thing. That's why the previous picture that I showed actually has a little dip in the beginning and at the end. Because the enzyme actually is taking smaller steps. And it actually, if we had more time in this class, what you would find actually is that what the enzyme actually is doing is it makes it more likely by taking these little more smaller steps one step at a time. That's how it's doing. But the key thing you should know is that it's actually lowering the activation energy. And it does that because you actually get to a more likely transition state, a more stable form of the transition state that you can actually get to more easily. Okay, so let me see. So how much am I? Oh, I'm over. Okay, so I have the rest of this lecture I'm going to finish on Saturday. It's actually much easier. Like I said, it's always, my lecture is always a lot of stuff at the beginning, and then kind of I just do a little bit of explanation. I also might run into the DNA genome stuff a little bit, but remember, you're not responsible for anything that I don't go over. And actually, there's a lot of material in this whole section that I think it's difficult to just do in one class. So I'll try to do the best we can, and then we try to understand it just like the way we do it today, one step at a time, like an enzyme, one step at a time. Because if you just take home little bits and pieces of this information, it's much better than trying to gobble up the entire thing. Okay? So, thank you very much. Somebody